I'm here with Max and Alyssa, my former colleagues at the DFR lab, who have also been staring down the bore of the 2022 midterm elections, which I don't know if you two are as tired now as I am, but I feel like I've been staring into screens for like 3 weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's always the bad screen as well. It's never the good screen.
It's been bad. I don't like following the horse race this microscopically and seeing everyone's like bad intrusive thoughts that they write in Telegram and on Truth Social, but here we are.
Yeah. So I wanted to just kind of recap. By the time this episode comes out, it'll be like 2-ish weeks since Election Day. And I don't know, I kind of feel like people were expecting a lot, especially off the heels of 2020. That just kind of didn't really happen. It's not that nothing happened, and I, you know, would like to talk about sort of what did happen, but I'm curious if either of you, you know, had expectations going in or any just sort of general thoughts before we dive in.
You know, there were some people talking online about how we were going to start seeing, you know, violence at drop boxes. And there certainly were narratives of, you know, people saying that they were going to organize these like stakeouts of drop box locations. But I feel like something that people get wrong about, like the election denialist narratives that, you know, drives people to suggest going out and like spectating a drop box, is that ultimately these people want the voting to go off without a hitch. They want it to go smoothly. And that's why, you know, we ended up seeing so many narratives about tabulation machines that were malfunctioning. It's because that's an opportunity for fraud, allegedly, right?
Yeah, like so many of the narratives were built on this idea that like the reason that Daddy Trump lost is because the elections are like faulting somehow. Alyssa, I'm curious your thoughts. Like, what were you thinking going in and how do you feel now?
To a large extent, like this is just our new normal. And this is, I think, just how elections in the US are going to be moving forward. There's always going to be some component of just like some strain of election denialism. And the question is just how virulent or how pervasive it is, or if it's unconvincing. But I think things like overall went much better than people were fearing. There's also this kind of weird double bind where you want election denialism to be motivating to whatever group you're spreading it in, but you don't want it to be too convincing.
Right.
So you don't want it to make it seem like the whole system is so illegitimate, there's no point in voting. So we saw a lot of, you know, like really like clear and really like loud like exhortations to go vote, to make sure your vote is counted and your voice is heard, which is really funny from some of the same communities that are spreading like the idea that your vote won't be heard, your voice doesn't count, and that's why, you know, Trump actually won, et cetera, et cetera. So kind of like straddling that paradox, I think, was interesting to see in real time.
Yeah, and you could even see it after Trump announced that he was going to run in 2024. Like, I was going through the Donald, or like whatever it's calling itself now, patriots.win, and people were like, oh, yeah, vote for Trump. Yeah, fat fucking chance. It's all rigged, dude. What's going on? Max, tell me a little bit about what DFR Lab has been up to in 2022 midterms. I remember working there, and it's a little bit under the radar. You guys are part of the Election Integrity Partnership, which does, you know, it's a big coalition of research. But day to day, what does that look like for you guys?
Generally, it's just kind of monitoring specific online spaces where people tend to congregate and talk about.
Do you have any favorite places where people discuss violence?
I tend to really enjoy browsing a Telegram. That's my favorite beat.
So you're looking for threats, discussions of violence. You guys also track like misinformation narratives too, right? Alyssa, can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah. So our specific mandate is kind of like the US/North American information environment, whatever that means. So any sort of like foreign interference or information operation, we will publish articles or do takedowns on. But I think the cool thing about working where we work is we work with a lot of colleagues who are focused on different countries. So for example, one of our colleagues actually today just published an article looking at misinformation and election denialism in the Brazilian election that happened. Mm.
Yeah.
Right before ours. So there's like a lot to be said there about the kind of like interplay between the US midterms and the Brazilian election attack.
Before the election, you guys were plugged in, watching things cook and develop. Alyssa, maybe you could start. Can you just tell listeners a little bit about kind of what you all were seeing? If anything kind of jumped out at you during, I don't know, the month or two running into elections that kind of stood out or really popped to the top of the radar?
It was really interesting. The Brazilian election happened on like October 30th. And obviously there were a lot of fraud narratives within the country that proliferated that Bolsonaro and kind of like his right-wing cadre were amplifying. And to see a lot of American influencers on the right kind of like take those narratives and run with them in the lead up to the US midterms was really fascinating. I think there's this kind of like under-discussed, potentially like global election denialism like current going on. So like barring foreign interference, like we typically think of elections as these like very hyper-regional affairs, but I don't know if that's the case anymore, just because election denialism in our country is our new normal. And that's the case in right-wing communities in many other countries like Brazil, Peru, etc. Seeing the interplay was super fascinating this time around. And I wonder going forward if we will see more of that.
Max, what about you? Did anything stick out in that before period that you were like, huh, this is going to be really interesting to watch?
Yeah, I feel like there was a lot of momentum on specifically the right wing, as you mentioned earlier, right? This red wave narrative was kind of spreading like a wild. And it's interesting to see how that kind of that momentum didn't follow through as soon as results started pouring in. And people lost a lot of confidence in the messaging that they had been, you know, pushing previously. Communities on, you know, formerly the Donald, currently Patriots.win. It had taken the wind out of a lot of people's sails. There was, a palpable change in tone as people started to like grapple with that.
Yeah, over at ISD, like one of the things that really caught my eye was, you know, over the last couple of years, there's been so much focus on machines and like the devices used for elections. I thought for sure, like, I didn't think this was going to be a widespread thing, but I thought for sure, like, some guy somewhere would like try to stick a USB drive into like a vote tabulator or like try to grab one of these machines and run out the door and dissect it the way that they have in states. Or I don't, it's like some Looney Tunes shit I thought was going to happen, but that didn't happen. You know, you talked about sort of that shift in vibe. It was kind of amazing just to see like how fast the wind fell out of everybody's sails. And I have theories about why that might be. You know, Alyssa, you mentioned election denialism is just kind of a hard sell. You have to like get people to believe it and get mobilized. But if they believe it too much, then they won't get mobilized. And maybe the calculation was off on that. I also think, you know, just over the past couple of years, watching, you know, these election deniers send their people into local Republican parties and sign them up for poll workers and stuff. Like if they were going to claim that it was rigged, who's to blame? It's like some of their own people, right? So I don't know if you guys have any other theories about maybe why the big red wave or these like giant tidal waves of misinformation didn't come like crashing and just dominate the discourse after the election.
Yeah, I sort of wonder, I mean, kind of speaking again to the logical inconsistencies in election denialism, you know, if people want to have, or if people thought there was going to be a red tsunami, they couldn't go too, they had to like turn the election denialism dial back a little bit, because otherwise it's like, well, you know, it was rigged, but we won. I wonder.
But it's cool now. Because we want.
Yeah. So I wonder about that, right? Like if certain things, actually, I kind of take that back. I was going to say like maybe people like Mike Lindell, like didn't go double down as much as they could have on certain like fraud narratives.
That would have been pretty hard for Lindell, Mike Lindell.
Lindell's just like doing his own thing on Frank speech or whatever his platform is.
Yeah, I don't know what a moderate Mike Lindell looks like.
Yeah. It's like zero or 100 for him for sure. But yeah, I guess I do wonder, like, if it had been anticipated that we were going to see, like, a blue wave, I do think we would have seen more, like, right-wing misinfo from the get-go.
Yeah, I mean, it also reminds me of the blue wave, right? Which is, like, something that was part of the discussion last year. Not last year, during our last election cycle, which also didn't entirely pan out, did it? So, perhaps just these grandiose claims in general about sweeping the Senate and the House, it just doesn't, you know, really kind of line up with the way that our electoral system is built. And then also to this point that you had earlier, Jared, that you know, somebody could come by and pick up a voting machine from a voting center. It's funny because I remember seeing videos of people going to get vaccinated and steal, like walking out with vials of Pfizer vaccines with the intention of somehow, I don't know,
like, we're going to find the biochips in here.
Yeah.
I saw like a lot of really great takes come during what I will, I guess, dub the cope and seethe portion of like the right's understanding of the midterm elections. And I think my favorite one, first off, so many like misinformation narratives that did exist and like did get seeded out there, recycled into blogs like the Gateway Pundit and stuff, came from like Charlie Kirk and his posse, right? Charlie Kirk was on his podcast this week, like trying to rationalize, being like, well, you know, turns out elections aren't about who has the best ideas or who works the hardest. It's all about, you know, who can get the most number of votes in this little time period. So maybe we need to focus on getting some more votes on our side. And I was like, yes, Charlie. Yes, it's electoral politics. I don't know. But
that's the name of the game. Yeah.
Yeah. You guys see any like great galaxy brain stuff?
I totally did. I don't remember what it was. It was so funny, though. It was so funny. Oh, yeah. I need to find it.
While Max is doing that, Alyssa, did you kind of sense any like themes in the way that the right was coming to understand, like, I guess specifically the election denialist right was trying to wrap their head around midterms?
I think one thing that really fascinated me were these like small scale narratives that like aren't really politically important, but kind of speak to people's distrust of the electoral process, and it were also kind of like repeats or just like slightly different variations on like big lie related narratives we saw during the 2020 election. So the idea that like if you vote with a blue pen, like way better, and it'll having a blue marker and marking your ballot with a blue marker will prevent cheating or whatever, some of these like random cross-platform narratives, I was kind of just interested in them and in that they were kind of like innocuous in isolation, but like kind of like could serve as fodder for broader 2022 election like related fraud narratives. But like they're kind of like proliferation on the day of. I don't know. I wondered how much it spoke to how people were perceiving or thinking of the electoral process and how illegitimate it was. And if that said something about how people weren't buying into, or how people were buying into election denialism in ways that were like ultimately counterproductive for the Republican Party.
Or at the very least, like a net neutral. Max, you found that take?
I did find a take. An extremely frustrating take, which it came from Truth Social. It was about how, you know, Florida has banned mail-in ballots and ballot harvesting requires voter ID. And allegedly, DeSantis as a governor created an election police force. And because of all that, there we witnessed a huge margin in Florida in favor of DeSantis. And apparently, you know, you can extrapolate this. Apparently, that is evidence of voter fraud nationally because of this margin and because of these voter suppression kind of efforts.
So because states didn't do what Ron DeSantis did, they did fraud.
It's evidence of fraud, correct?
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a podcast about big ideas, people. Alyssa, you were saying something earlier I want to kind of go back to, which is just kind of conveying the sense that like this is kind of maybe just what we can expect from elections from here out. Like this round didn't seem to turn out as bad as it could have. You know, there's certainly a bunch of just bullshit out in the ether floating around, but at least at the time of recording, there's not like mass protests anywhere or anything really kind of coming together and mobilizing and, you know, being really dangerous the way it was in 2020. But, you know, I guess, can you elaborate on that? Like, what exactly do you mean when you say that, you know, this is what elections are probably just going to be like from now on?
Probably tenseness and anticipation for like our specific group and our field of work, right? But I think in the aftermath of 2020, we saw so many people and influencers and entities kind of like spring up to continue perpetuating like 2020 was stolen narratives. So like both like top down, like people like Mike Lindell and their silly conferences and the like all the documentary films and stuff that have been produced and distributed in various ways to kind of like continuously sow 2020 big lie narratives, you know, like that. And then kind of like the bottom up people who are buying into it, or, you know, just saying the phrase 2000 mules, I think evokes something that's so much larger than just that movie itself It's like you can say it and refer to kind of like broader election denialist sympathies or ideas just by saying 2000 Mules Net, which is pretty fascinating that it struck such a chord in so many people. So I think that hasn't gone away. And if anything, has just like those ideas have like continued to kind of like build on top of each other. So we're going to keep seeing that as we keep having elections, because then there's just more content to like sow more doubt about. I think the question, though, is how large of a component of the voting public will actually believe in election denialism going forward, right? So like, I would imagine, my guess would be that some people who maybe were like, 2020 didn't feel right, it was fishy, maybe some of them are still like, yeah, 2022 didn't feel right, these midterms were also fishy, but you know, some of them are probably like, maybe I was a volunteer for my local like election like poll place, like they told, like people encouraged me to, or you know, I don't think everyone will buy into it. So I do wonder, depending on how the broader political climate looks like in the US and the kind of like officials and politicians that either continue to spread big lie narratives or kind of step back from them as Trump no longer has the same political capital in the way he used to.
I'm going to make an assertion, and I want to see if you two agree with this or disagree with this, or if maybe there's some nuance to be had, because I'm going to make a very simple statement, which is that even though this election, I think from the outside looking in, like we have a very weird perspective on this, right? Because we look at this stuff all day. Most people, thank God, do not. You know, we have the same media diet as like the worst uncle at Thanksgiving, right? So we see this stuff pretty close. But I think from the outside looking in, you know, somebody might have heard all this discussion about, you know, misinformation is going to be crazy and like militia guys are going to be at the drop box and the polling place and you got to be careful and yada, yada, yada. But like then nothing really crazy happened, right? And I kind of wonder if, at least in media, we're still seeing like an overcorrection from 2020, because a lot of major news outlets seem to really miss the ball on that and have been sort of overcompensating in various ways. You know, there's like a ton of amazing beat reporters and reporters on these issues, but like I'm talking about like the big networks, like the Justice reporters and stuff that have to care about this now. You know, I guess I would say to that a lot of these threats to like little d democracy still exist, right? Even if they didn't really rear their heads up. And I think it would be a mistake to have the takeaway from these midterms to be like, oh, well, maybe this isn't as big of an issue as people think it is. So, Alyssa, I'll pass to you. I'm curious if you would have any thoughts on like that kind of assertion, if you agree with it, if there's some nuance there, or like if somebody, you know, came up to you and was like, oh, you study this stuff, you look at this stuff, well, that wasn't really that big of a deal, huh? Like, what would you say to that?
Yeah, in general, I think, you know, there's sometimes these myopic trends to say focus on like solely disinformation and disinformation's effect on democracy or right-wing extremism. And, you know, like, as we all know, kind of, I think it's important to take a more like holistic and like broader scale view, right? In that there's this like component in the US that is like extreme right-wing Christian, like theocratic, that are like threatening human and civil rights in the US. A lot of groups are like the Proud Boys, for example, who are, you know, continuously targeting drag performers. But there's like a lot of right-wing groups who are like really focusing their vitriol on like the LGBTQ community, like the libs of TikTok, like the fact that the Boston Children's Hospital has been like on like their third bomb threat or something for their care of like trans children. The threats to human and civil rights in the US threaten like everyone's ability to participate in society and thus threaten our ability to like have democracy. But that's kind of maybe like a three arrows point, like to get to that threat to democracy. But I think that is very salient. And I'm very concerned by kind of the narratives around that. Because I think some coverage does focus, you know, perhaps by definition, since it's like a journalistic article and can only be so many words, just focuses on kind of like, here's this, what this right-wing group is doing, or this disinfo that's targeting an election. And like the long-term effects, I think, are what really concerns me.
Yeah, that makes total sense, especially what you're saying about how, you know, even if this didn't like blow up during an election, it's still creating this like overall kind of hostile environment, especially to members of minority groups and stuff, that, and if they don't feel safe to engage in society at their full selves, then this whole democracy thing just doesn't work. Max, I'm curious if you had thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the denialism take is a specifically dangerous one because we kind of don't really know how it pans out in the long term. I think that, you know, for somebody like Trump in 2020, it can be constructive for their campaign. It can work to support his kind of subversive and prosecuted identity as a political figure and help his eligibility as a candidate who, instead of losing an election, was robbed of a win. But at the same time, it's not necessarily a sustainable stance because a tails I win, heads you lose approach will eventually kind of wear down the democratic process. In the event an election denialist candidate wins, their constituents and the voter base needs to be confident in that outcome. And I feel like election denialists take that for granted or aren't concerned with the lasting ramifications of, you know, that kind of campaign. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, election denialism was replicated in 2022 as it was in 2020, and presumably again in 2024. So it'll be interesting to see how it becomes even more of a threat.
All right, Max and Alyssa, I want to close this thing down with some hot takes. Max. Oof. Is Trump going to win in 2024?
Is Trump going to get nominated in 2024?
Let's start there. Is he getting nominated?
Ooh, I don't know. I'm really looking forward to seeing how this Trump DeSantis thing pans out. So it'll be interesting to see how he kind of, you know, pits heads against a peer who, for that matter, has based their identity off of Trump as well. Even the way he poses in pictures is very Trump-esque.
Oh, he talks like Trump too. It's hilarious.
Yes, he holds his hands like Trump.
Do you remember the like DeSantis campaign commercial where he put his baby in like a Trump onesie?
I do remember that. Yeah.
Amazing. Amazing. And this guy's going to take on the king, huh? Alyssa, Trump, is he getting that nomination? Do you believe the National Review when they're like, wow, I guess it's time for the Republican Party to move on from Trump? Do you think that's genuine? I mean, I'll give you my take. I think they're just going to fall back in line as soon as Trump says like, weak little Ron DeSantis or something.
I am very excited to see the nicknames that come up over the next few years. Like, I think we're going to have some really fun nicknames when this is over. We've already seen some good ones for DeSantis from Trump, but we'll see more. You know, I wonder if someone like equally terrible or worse, I don't know if it's DeSantis, but someone like DeSantis will capture the nomination instead. But I don't know.
Max, were tech platforms better prepared for the 2022 election and misinformation than they were in 2020? Were the moderation efforts any better?
I think both yes and no. It's a little bit of a false equivalency. 2020 was such a huge election on a scale that, you know, the midterms just kind of aren't. I certainly saw less discrete narratives spreading around the 2022 midterms than I did in 2020. But I feel like also the stakes were a little bit lower. It wasn't a presidential election.
Mm. That's fair. That's fair. It's a different situation.
I think the tech platforms did do better this time around, but I think it actually doesn't matter as much. Like the question is just like way less important because so many people are already on different platforms, right? Whether it's like Truth Social or Odyssey and Gab or what have you. Like the question is like almost less relevant.
It's like antiquated almost. Huh. Max, is Twitter going to die? Is Elon Musk going to kill Twitter?
Gosh,
yes or no?
Gosh, I hope so.
So yes or no, is Elon Musk going to kill Twitter?
Yeah, definitely.
Definitely.
I think so. And it's wonderful to see the geopolitical prominence of Grimes, something I've been thinking about a lot lately, although, you know, always thinking about her. But like the role that a few ridiculous characters could play in influencing Elon. Like everyone saw his previous ex-wife texting about buying Twitter and then deleting it. Is that actually going to come true? Hilarious.
It's just like, how cool does Grimes have to be that like when she leaves you, you buy a major tech platform and smash it into the ground?
The poetic justice of another of her exes being Chelsea Manning, too, who's trying to put more information out into the world versus the ex who's actively quashing future information.
Yeah, the Chad whistleblower versus the virgin billionaire that
bought
the platform.
Yeah, perfect.
Well, where are you guys going to go? Like I kind of said, I kind of feel like I'm just going to camp out on a newsletter and podcast and just maybe enjoy some more quality time with my dog or something.
I relish the opportunity to not fill the space once Twitter is gone. I think that as much good as Twitter does as a platform, it's probably done far more harm.
I agree. Wikipedia is where it's at. Just do a lot more link hopping for fun when you're distracted.
Oh, man. Dude, what if Wikipedia like absorbed, let's say like 70% of Twitter that leaves? And
Well, that was the plan all along, wasn't it? Where Elon Musk proposed that Twitter should become by far the most reliable source of information on the internet.
A public square, yeah.
Yeah, you're reading like a World War One article about, like, you know, the ships that were used, and there's just like annotations from cat turd two left for review.
Yes. Yeah, that's a $1 billion idea, and I think you could find some VCs that would fund that. Like, it's kind of fun to watch YouTube videos and then read the comments. Like, it is, there's something beautiful about that. Oh, sometimes.
Definitely.
There's also like a large incumbent population on Wikipedia who are already waging that information war, who I'm sure would have a good time being displaced by Twitter, like Twitter users.
Nothing could go wrong.
Do your podcast followers want to know that Caroline Ellison went to my high school?
Wait, who's Caroline Ellison?
This is a good point. I think they do.
Wait, what is the...
The FTX scandal?
Oh my god, yeah. We didn't talk about that at all. You have like a connection to that?
She went to Newton North High School. Maybe I shouldn't say that because I am doxing myself, but she did go to my high school. But she was a little bit older, so I didn't know her.
So you guys,
so it's actually not that cool of a story.
You guys were like best friends, right?
I'm actually like filming this. This is from the Bahamas as we speak. I was in the polycule.
I've been talking to Max and Alyssa, my former colleagues at the DFR lab, reflecting on 2022 midterms. But I do have one question left for them both. And it's the question every guest on this show gets. What's your favorite thing on the internet right now? Max, let's start with you.
For me, it's got to be this Twitter thread where somebody has posted a 52-part thread containing the entire original Fast and Furious movie split into like 2-minute chunks. Yeah, that's just phenomenal. I love that. Mods are gone.
Yeah, I can't think of like anything better to do with, you know, 2/3 of Twitter staff out than just post a bunch of copyrighted content that you wouldn't have otherwise.
The first post in the thread is just the Universal Studios like banner. So it's great.
Amazing. I feel like that's going to hurt Twitter more than anything is the like cutting people and not being able to enforce that kind of stuff, because advertisers and like companies actually do care about that shit, right? More than they care about people, you know, saying whatever misinformation or hate speech or whatever. Like, that's intellectual theft in their books, right? So they're going to get mad about that. Alyssa, what's your favorite thing on the internet?
Yeah, there's this YouTube video about this guy who's skiing and falls into a crevasse, and then he's stuck in a crevasse and he has a GoPro on, and eventually he gets rescued, but it's just like wonderful to watch, because I always am like, hell yeah, I'm not stuck in a crevasse right now. And it has like 17 million views. So highly recommend.
That's great, because there is like decision making there, right? You get stuck in the crevasse, you get rescued. And then at some point, the guy's brain was like, other people need to see this.
For a while, it was his like one of his only videos. And now he posts other really crazy videos very occasionally. But you get the helicopter ride at the end of the like 10-minute video. That's very exhilarating.
What is it called?
Nice.
I just, the day I fell into a crevasse.
Quality vlog, right?
Yeah,
there.
Good stuff. I love not being in a crevasse. I'm so grateful for that. And the video reminds me.
Speaking of helicopter rides in the smoothest segue known to man, my favorite thing on the internet right now has been Microsoft Flight Simulator, which I purchased for, I want to say like $60, some indiscriminate amount of time ago, and I remembered that I owned like last week, and have since been flying around virtual Cessna planes around towns that I used to live in, and, you know, just doing a whole bunch of, you know, the world's best activity, which is looking out the window and go, huh, look at that.
Love it.
All right, Max, Alyssa, thanks so much for joining this week.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.